I want to take a break from the podcast right now, and I want to give you a gift. And I want to do that to thank you for being a listener. I put my heart and soul into this podcast. I love interviewing today's experts, researchers, MDs, psychologists, sleep trainers, you name it. I hope you feel inspired to take care of yourselves and your families. And I just want to thank you for being a listener and hanging out with me. So the code PODCAST10 is going to give you a one-time $10 off code at kellylevesque.com, your next order of protein powder. You can either use that on my grass-fed beef isolate protein or on my new vegan chocho bean protein. Now, here's what I love about my protein powders. It's 3 ingredients or less. So we don't use fillers, emulsifiers, no fortified vitamins or minerals. It's easy to digest and naturally made without any enzymes or chemicals like hexane. So it's 3 ingredients. With my grass-fed beef isolate, that's 100% grass-fed beef, and it's made in the way that you would make bone broth. So just heat and water. And we dehydrate that end product to get that collagen-rich protein powder that your whole family can drink. It can be added to coffees, to smoothies, and you can get it in vanilla, chocolate, and unflavored. I want to point out that my vanilla and chocolate is made with organic vanilla bean, organic cacao, and the only sweetener used is organic monk fruit. We don't use any maltodextrin. Our monk fruit is 100% ground monk fruit, and it's organic. And with my vegan line, I'm so excited to have launched this and to have it out into the world. It's a regenerative bean from South America called the chocho bean. And the chocho bean is the most superior plant-based protein powder you can get your hands on, because not only is it a complete protein, but the process is made with heat and water only. They're crushed and soaked, and what that end product results in is an anti-nutrient-free protein powder. So you're not gonna have any lectins, phytates, or oxalates in your protein powder. Makes it super easy to digest, and it's really, really delicious and robust in cooking as well. So I love it if I want a thicker smoothie or a smoothie bowl. And I also love it in my baked goods, from my cookies to my muffins, pancakes, and breads. It's the perfect protein addition. So if you want to give either of these proteins a try, or you've already been purchasing these proteins and want to take advantage of this special deal, the code PODCAST10 is going to get you $10 off for being a listener here at the Be Well by Kelly podcast. So head to kellylevesque.com or bewellbykelly.com. Put the protein you'd like to purchase in your cart and use the code PODCAST10 for $10 off. Thank you, thank you, thank you for tuning in. Dr. Aviva Ram is a Manhattan-based integrative women and children's physician and the author of The Adrenal Thyroid Revolution and her brand new book, Hormone Intelligence, the complete guide to calming hormone chaos and restoring your body's natural blueprint for well-being. Dr. Ram did her medical training and internship in internal medicine at Yale School of Medicine and her residency in family medicine and obstetrics at Tufts University Medicine Residency. She's also a midwife and herbalist and a graduate of the University of Arizona's Integrative Medicine Residency Program. Dr. Ram is the most well-versed in female hormones, and I'm so excited to welcome her to today's show. Aviva, thank you so much for joining me today. We talked about it before the show started, but I feel like we have been orbiting each other for years, and just coming together feels right. So thank you for being here and spending the time.
Oh my gosh, Kelly, thank you so much for making space to have me on your show. I love the work you're doing, and I love just you bring such a whole nourishing perspective to the food space, which is so important.
Well, thank you. I feel like you do the exact same thing in the female hormone space. It can be so confusing to women when they're told they're hormonal, or they don't know what their hormones are throughout the cycle during a month, or, you know, with all of these, what you're calling the hidden hormone epidemic, we're all kind of dealing with dysfunction and we just don't know where to start and how to understand our hormones. And you just wrote this book, Hormone Intelligence, to help educate people in this space. So can you talk about the book and the meaning behind the title and how you came up with it?
Absolutely. So you're right. I mean, so many women are struggling. And because of my work, which is as a midwife and an MD in women's health, of course, naturally, just like you hear from your audience all the time, I hear tens of thousands of stories of women who are struggling with so many different faces of hormone problems. And a big reason I wrote the book is, yes, to absolutely address the confusion and the lack of knowledge. But even going one step back, I know that as women, as moms, often the first thing we do when something isn't going right is we blame ourselves, or we think there's something wrong with us, or that we're broken. And so a big theme of this book for me is that there's nothing wrong with you and you're not broken. But what's happening is that there is this hidden hormone epidemic. I mean, 80% of women over the course of our lives will seek out a medical consultation for a hormone problem. And I don't just mean like a menstrual cramp or a little bit of PMS. I mean, something that's really affecting them enough to go seek medical care or get a diagnosis. One in six women now goes in for a fertility consultation. One in eight has a hormonal metabolic condition called polycystic ovary syndrome. One in 10 has an immune inflammatory hormone problem called endometriosis. And a staggering 30% of us will have a hysterectomy, if not in our 30s and 40s, in our 50s and 60s, usually for benign problems like fibroids. And don't even get me started on the, you know, decreasing age that girls are going into puberty. It's shocking. So there's this epidemic and women are blaming ourselves and we're living with it in silence for a number of reasons, which is why I call it this hidden hormone epidemic. One is a lot of people don't know that what they're experiencing isn't just par for the course of being a woman. So an example that I hear all the time is, well, my mom had the periods from hell. She was bent over. She had to stay in bed for 2 days. She had to miss work for a day every month. And so when I got my period and it was the period from hell, I just thought that's what periods were supposed to be. So I lived with that from the time I was 14 till I was 25. And then I found out it wasn't, you know, like I hear these stories over and over. So sometimes we just don't know what's normal and isn't, and we live with it. But often women do go to the doctor and the doctor's just like, that's normal. You're a woman. Take the pill, take ibuprofen. And it's not that physicians are necessarily intentionally being callous. Most of us are not, but we're not taught what's normal and not in medical school, short of like overt, this is like really serious. You know, you've got cancer or something, but we're not taught to recognize endometriosis, polycystic ovary syndrome. And even for things like PMS and period problems, we're literally just taught to throw the pill or another pharmaceutical at it. And so a lot of times women go to the doctor and they're like, well, my doctor told me it was normal, so it must be, or my doctor didn't give me any answers, so I should live with it. And I think the numbers are getting missed in medical education. So, I mean, the pandemic that we're all hopefully a little bit on the other side of, but it affected everyone and it affected everyone so obviously that it's gotten necessary attention. But the reality is that more women were struggling with any one of those hormone problems before and will be after the pandemic than people who got really sick in the pandemic. But because of historical biases in medicine, a lot of these things are not being studied. They're not getting the attention they need. So that's why I wrote the book now. It's to provide those missing answers, to help women self-assess, and then to understand you're not broken, but here's what is broken: food, sleep, our life cycles, our lifestyles, so many factors that conspire to create these problems that we experience now.
Oh, I mean, I feel like you're preaching to the choir. I worked with so many women over the last decade that come to me after a diagnosis of PCOS, after a diagnosis of endometriosis, and they look back on high school and staying home with period, like horrible period cramps and feeling horrible, and they were told that was normal and they just took a few days off of school, got through it in college, and then, you know, come to find out when they're thinking about having children or trying to get pregnant, that feels like this point in which they're finally being taken seriously and then they're just referred off to fertility.
Right. And now they've been dealing with it in some suppressed way, usually because they've been on the pill for 15 years. And the bottom line is that all that while, underlying damage may still have been happening that they now have to deal with. I see that all the time too.
So can we talk about some of the symptoms that you might see for the hidden hormone epidemic and what women should start to look out for at, maybe we can break it down at the earlier years, maybe through fertility years and then perimenopausal?
Yeah, Okay, so cool. Bottom line is that being a woman is not a diagnosis. So we shouldn't have symptoms just because we're women. Mm-hmm. So let me explain that a little bit. It's very normal premenstrual. Well, let's just go back to puberty. It's right. very normal during those first few years after we get our menstrual cycles for our period blood to be brown and not bright red, or sometimes it might be brown, sometimes it might be bright red. So even going to some wellness websites might confuse young girls because they'll, or their moms, because they'll read, oh, period blood means you have, brown blood means you have stagnation or this problem or that problem. But actually, it's pretty normal. The other thing in puberty, and for those 3 years or so, 3 or 4 years after we get our periods, once they first start, it's really normal for periods to be irregular. I remember the first year I got my period like, must have been about May or June. And then I didn't have my period for the whole summer. And I was so grateful. I was like, oh, I don't have to think about this at the beach. That kind of gap is really normal. By the time we hit about 16 to 20, depending on when we got our period, so giving yourself like a 3 to 4 year window of irregularity, then cycles start to get regular. That can be anywhere from 26 to 32 or 34 days apart. So backing up to puberty, and then all the way through our life cycles, our periods should never, ever cause us to feel miserable, doubled over in pain, shouldn't even require us to have to take ibuprofen every month. So if your period is causing you enough discomfort that you're having to take medication every month, or take that day or two off from your sports or from your job or school, then something's going on. And that something doesn't necessarily mean it's a disease. It doesn't necessarily mean you have endometriosis or a medical problem, but it means that something's off balance. Often what it is we're getting so much exposure to estrogen through our diet and through our environments that we start to have really heavy periods, and our periods are more painful when they're heavy. But even if you don't have a heavy period, a lot of us just have a lot more underlying inflammation due to all of the exposures we get, again, through our environment, through our food, disruptions in our microbiome, lack of sleep, more stress. And inflammation is a key cause of period pain. Inflammation is also an underlying cause of endometriosis, polycystic ovary syndrome, uterine fibroids. So these are important root causes, as I call them, to pay attention to. So just keep in mind that your period should never make you miserable. Menopause should never make you miserable. If it is, then you want to look under the hood and say, what's going on? Once you get into your 20s, well, teenagers in 20s, acne is often a really big issue. Women are really struggling with acne. Having a zit here or there is not, it's annoying if you don't want to have one or have to do something on camera, but that's not necessarily a hormone imbalance. But if you're struggling with chronic acne, and absolutely if you have cystic acne, your body shouldn't do that just because you have a hormone situation, just because you have hormones. So again, that's another reason to look under the hood. If you hit your late teens and 20s and you're still having pretty irregular periods, either they're longer than 34 days, they're shorter than 26 days, they're more than 4 days apart on average, cycle to cycle. So if you have a period that's 28 days one month, 32 days the next month, 30 days the next month, that's not really an irregular period. Most women do not actually have menstrual cycles like clockwork. They tend to vary a little bit by a couple of days a month. And on average, menstrual cycles around the world are not 28 days. They're 29.5 days. So this idea that if you have a healthy cycle, you're like ovulating at the full new moon and bleeding at the full moon. It's very romantic, but don't judge yourself. Yeah. So if you're falling outside of those parameters where your cycle's extremely irregular, super long, super short, that will suggest a hormone problem. Similarly, if you are having periods that you're skipping periods, you know, for months at a time, that's often a symptom of polycystic ovary syndrome. And then one question I get a lot is, well, how do I know if my period is too heavy? So a normal period should last about 3 to 7 days. If it's longer than 7 days, or if you're going through pad after pad, tampon after tampon, really more than 6 or 8 pads or tampons a day, that suggests a heavier period. Even on day two, which is usually heavier for most women, you shouldn't be like essentially hemorrhaging through your pads and tampons. So if that's happening also, that would be an indication to have, you know, have a conversation with someone who's in the know. Certainly I provide those answers in the book as well, but it's still good to have someone you can consult with. Mood. So it's really normal to, and natural, I don't want to say normal because normal could also mean common, but it's really natural to want to be much more withdrawn, internal, private, quiet, watch Netflix, chill out, read a book on those couple of days before your period. That doesn't mean you have PMS. It's just how our hormones roll. We want that kind of more nurturing, quiet time. And I truly believe that something happens premenstrually where our verbal and emotional filter goes down. Like, I have definitely learned not to send certain emails in those couple of days before my period. Like, let me just save that and revisit that in a few days. But if your cycles are making you wildly, erratically emotional, or making you feel like I couldn't live with myself right now, or they're making you miserable, then definitely something needs to give, because we shouldn't feel that way as part of just normally having hormones. So either something's going on with your hormones, or sometimes something's going on in your life. And when that filter goes down, it's more at the surface. So yes, it could be that your hormones really do need a little bit of TLC, and that's why you're feeling wildly, erratically emotional. But if the same thing is coming up for you month after month about your relationship or your boss or your best friend or your mom or your neighbor, whatever it is, take a step back and check in with yourself. You know, I like to think of it this way as when we lived kind of more primitively, when we lived much more, you know, tribal. 1,000 years, yeah, tribal, like 1,000 years ago, we would have a hormonal surge. Whether that was, let's just say it's ovulation, right? The hormonal surge creates an urge to have sex because biology is trying to get us to get pregnant. And 1,000 years ago, women didn't have the option to say, well, I'm going to get a condom, or I'm not going to have sex right now, or I'm going to be on the pill, or whatever it is. So we had surge, urge, action. Now we have surge, urge. It still happens, but then hit pause on think, then action, right? Yeah. So stepping back and just checking in. But the bottom line, you know, Kelly, is our hormones should never make us miserable.
Yeah, it's so interesting because it is so common, and everyone has, so many people have symptoms that are related to hormones. Yeah. And oftentimes dismissed as just being hormonal.
Yes.
Can we unpack that word a little bit? And I know you have an opinion about it, and I would just love for you to share.
Yeah, it's up there with the C word. Not quite as bad, because it's like anyone can say it, right? But in a way, it's kind of a milder version. And so, yeah, we're dismissed. It is a word that is used to deride and devalue us when we say something potent, powerful, maybe with a charge of emotion around it. And what also makes me sad is that we sometimes apologize for ourselves, and, or we use it as an excuse, like, I ate that whole cake, I was hormonal. Or, you know, I chewed my partner out, I was hormonal. But we kind of apologize for what we did instead of like, wow, I was really hungry and really craving sugar and I ate that cake. Or, yeah, my boyfriend really pissed me off and I said what I really wanted to say. And so we backpedal. I think when we say that we're hormonal, when we're talking about our emotions and our physical selves, I think that's a little bit different. I think we all know, you know, if we were to say to our sisters or our best friends, I'm feeling really hormonal, then we're talking about something that often is happening as a result. It's like we're expressing a symptom or expressing a feeling of discomfort that we have a sense has something to go along with our biology. And we also have a sense that it has something to go along with our biology, either at a certain time of month or in a certain life cycle. Like, oh my gosh, first trimester pregnancy. Let's talk about the emotions that, like crying at a television commercial, right? Or getting nauseated at a food commercial. I've had patients who have had that happen. or perimenopause, menopause, where our emotions are transit, or puberty, right? We have emotions that happen as a result of these changes that we have in our hormones day to day and cycle to cycle. It's just, how do we learn to work with those and understand those and respect those? And then when they are driving us too hard, how do we step back and say something's going on and I need to figure out, is it something in my biology? Is it something in my life or both?
Yeah. If someone were to self-assess and try to understand if their hormones were balanced or imbalanced, what advice would you have for them?
So find some good checklists that you can look at and understand your basic cycle biology and your life cycles. So for example, we know certain very basic things are supposed to happen that make us feel a certain way physically and emotionally around ovulation. So we actually feel a really enhanced mood. We may feel an increase in our sex drive. We may feel a burst of creativity, but we also have some physical sensations. We have increased cervical mucus, just different, you know, we just know that something is different happening at that time of the month than is happening premenstrually, as we just talked about. So learning the language of your cycle and then understanding which hormones are at play. And it's not rocket science. There's basically the two big ones are estrogen and progesterone. Estrogen dominates the first half. Progesterone dominates the second half of the cycle. And they each, you know, kind of like those five languages of love. I should do a book, The Five Languages of Our Hormones. You know, someone's going to hear that. I should do that though. But each hormone speaks through a different language. It has a different tempo. It makes us feel differently. So when you really start to understand that, you're like, oh, you know, I think estrogen is coming on board a little stronger right now. Not that I think that. I don't think about estrogen that way. I don't say in my mind, oh, I have more estrogen right now. But we start to notice where we are. But the other thing is, like in my book, and I'm sure there are lots of websites, you can find checklists of what the different hormones do and how they make you feel when they're too high or too low. And just kind of clicking through those checklists, you'll get the answer.
I love it. I love quizzes. I love checklists. They allow for you to not self-diagnose, but at least take an assessment of what's going on in your body.
Yeah. And you know, I know that especially in the wellness space, and I mean, for me as a physician, I can use the word diagnose more freely. But the reality is, Kelly, half of women with polycystic ovary syndrome don't know they have it because they haven't been diagnosed with it. And I don't want us to start over-pathologizing and diagnosing everyone left and right for all these things. But untreated polycystic ovary syndrome has all the same lifelong consequences as untreated diabetes. And so and especially if you're thin and you have polycystic ovary syndrome, your doctor might say, oh, well, you're thin. You couldn't possibly have it. If you're a fuller-bodied woman and you go to your doctor, your doctor may say something like, well, if you just lose the weight, you wouldn't have these problems. And with endometriosis, it takes on average in the United States 9 years of a woman going from doctor to doctor to doctor with no diagnosis. And we know that at least 60 to 70% of the women who ultimately do get the who were saying they had those symptoms, ultimately do get a confirmed diagnosis of PCOS. So as much as I do want everyone to have a care provider, nurse midwife, nurse practitioner, MD, who can give you a diagnosis, we do have to be our own medical detectives. And that's why I was so emphatic about putting these checklists in the book, because I want you to be able to sort of self-assess or self-diagnose, and then you can bring it to a provider, bring that book, bring that checklist, and the checklist will all live on my website also, but you can bring it to your provider and say, hey, I have this checklist. And when your doctor says, where'd you get your medical degree, Dr. Google, you can be like, actually, no, I got this off the website of a Yale-trained women's doctor. And that's like, I want people to have information they can leverage up to help support them getting the answers that they need.
And that's exactly what you're doing. We're so thankful for your work, Aviva.
Thank you.
You mentioned earlier in the podcast that food, sleep, and lifestyle affects hormones. Yeah. Can you unpack that a little bit for us and talk about the recommendations you make for your clients and patients? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I have a feeling we'll be pretty on par or copacetic with a lot of this. So with food, two things. Well, let me actually back up and say the premise that I approach health and actually sit with my patients and think through is two questions. What is this woman sitting in front of me or reaching out to me or writing to me on the internet about? What is she getting too much that's overburdening her body's natural capacity for health and healing? And what is she getting too little of that her body needs for health and healing? And so then when we approach each of these areas, for example, food, sleep, stress, etc., environmental exposures, if we frame everything, and that's what I do in the book, because it's literally how I think through all my patient care, is, okay, what are the foods that are overburdening our capacity to heal and stay well? And a lot of that is foods that trigger inflammation or foods that disrupt our blood sugar balance. So basically the plan that I go to for food is a whole foods plant-based approach. It doesn't mean vegan or vegetarian, but the diet is primarily plant-based. Whole foods to me means, first of all, you're taking out all processed food. Processed food is not food. So I don't even feel bad. I don't, like, if you feel restricted because you're taking out processed food, I'm sorry. I don't want you to feel restricted by that, but that's not food. So that stuff's gotta go. And sugar too, because sugar is a processed food. There's room for a little bit of honey, a little bit of maple syrup, a little bit of stevia, but a little bit, and not while you're like in the first part of the healing plan. So this is not restrictive at all. But we know that all these foods or non-food junk, as I call it, are causing inflammation. And we know that the amount of sugar and processed carbs in our diet are causing insulin resistance. And here's the beauty of it is if you take care of this for your hormones now, you won't be paying later with diabetes and heart disease and dementia, because we know 85% of chronic disease that affects us in our 50s and beyond has nothing to do with genetics. 15% maybe is genetics. The rest is truly what's overburdening our system. So the other thing with food is that I spend a lot of time talking about endocrine disruptors in my work because I feel like they're hugely important for what's going on with our hormonal health. But it starts with food, because our biggest endocrine disruptors are actually coming in our food in the forms of herbicides and pesticides. So an endocrine disruptor is a toxin or chemical that comes into our body and mimics our own hormones in a way that it either activates or overactivates a hormonal process or blocks a hormonal process. So a lot of the common ones are overactivating and overstimulating estrogen so that we end up with functionally way too much estrogen, and blocking thyroid hormone. Those are two really big ones. So I'm huge on anything that you can do to go organic, especially meat and dairy. That's like non-negotiable, because of there's just so much contamination because they have fat, and fat holds those environmental chemicals, those pesticides and herbicides. And then as much as you can with your produce. And I know it can get expensive, so don't spend $4.95 on a peach unless you really, really want that peach and it's organic. But follow like the environmental working group, Clean 15 and Dirty Dozen. The Clean 15 are the ones that you don't have to worry so much whether they're organic. The Dirty Dozen are the ones stay away from unless you can afford them organic, pretty much. And then food storage containers. And it may sound like, well, how much plastic is really going to get into my food if I put hot stuff in food storage containers? How much plastic am I really going to get out of my plastic drinking water bottle? It doesn't have to be very much. Hormones work at the level of, imagine if you took one drop of blue dye and dropped it in a completely full Olympic swimming pool. That's the volume of hormone that it needs to activate what's going on in your body. It's parts per million. And when we are drinking out of plastic water bottles, when we are storing our food in plastic containers and heating it up in plastic containers, when we are getting those herbicides and pesticides, it really does affect our hormones. And the great news, I mean, this is the amazing news. It's low-hanging fruit. It's work to learn how to change your diet. But I'm sure, I mean, you and I eat this way all the time. I don't think about myself as being on a certain kind of diet. I just eat this way. And it's second nature. It's not hard. I promise, once you know how to do it. There's so many accessible things, glass water bottles now, Target. You can go to Target. You can go to Amazon. It doesn't have to cost you a fortune to get glass storage containers for your food. They'll usually have like a plastic or rubber top. Just don't pack your food up to it. But it can make a huge difference. And here's the thing. We've seen the difference in studies. So there are studies where you just take kids who are eating a conventional non-organic diet, measure their urine, measure their blood, and then put them on an organic diet for 5 days, remeasure their urine, remeasure their blood, and that stuff has washed out. And that is really cool. Studies done on teenage girls who, if you just take their suntan lotion and body lotion out, which often has these chemicals in it, and you're putting it all over your body, and take the plastic drinking water and plastic cups out, in a week, you can measure a significant reduction in something called phthalates, which are plastic, kind of a plasticizer that are in a lot of plastic containers, but also in a lot of cosmetics and scented things. So scented detergent, scented, you know, the air freshener in the Uber. So that is probably like the lowest hanging fruit that I would encourage everyone, even if they don't do anything else, work with your diet. It really can do some amazing things. Sleep, we all need 7 to 9 hours a night. And I would say the biggest thing you can do for sleep is get off of your electronics about an hour before bed. Honestly, even read a real book, not a Kindle or anything on a, you know, iPad. If you really have to be on your computer at night for some reason, use the dimmer function that's now built into most devices and get blue blocking glasses. And it's not just that 7 hours of sleep is important, but 7 hours at night is important. During the day, we're producing a lot of a hormone called cortisol. And it's a really important hormone for inflammation and healing and energy. But at night, that's supposed to go down. When we stay on our electronics, it prevents cortisol from going down because it's tricking our brain into thinking it's still daytime. And what happens is not only is it harder to go to sleep and stay asleep, but when cortisol goes down, something called melatonin is supposed to go up. Melatonin is not just a sleep hormone. It actually detoxifies our brain while we're sleeping. But here's the thing, and this is a cool fact that I learned actually when I started doing the research for this book. I didn't even know this. Our ovaries require a huge amount of melatonin for when we ovulate to keep that egg healthy, but also that egg, when the process of ovulation requires a lot of energy. And that energy produces a lot of free radicals. And melatonin's job is to keep that egg healthy so that it can form a healthy embryo. Sleep is so important. And then stress, of course. Stress and lack of sleep produce all the same kind of hormone imbalances. It can affect our thyroid function when we're under a lot of stress. Our brain doesn't know what the stress is. Is it a famine? Is it a warring tribe about to attack us? Am I being chased by a tiger? Or was it just, you know, my notifications have been going off all day and setting my alarm bells off? Your brain really doesn't differentiate, actually. And when your brain gets activated in a chronic stress process, I call it getting stuck in the on position, your brain is saying to your body, hey, this is a really stressful time. I don't think this is a great time to reproduce. We need to protect this person right here. And so your brain-ovary connection gets disrupted and ovulation gets disrupted. Your cycles get disrupted. So that can really affect your hormones too. So much. And it sounds overwhelming, but it's really not when you break it down. It's some pretty basic stuff.
No, I love that you've broken it down into those buckets. I love that you talk about endocrine disrupting chemicals because those studies that you're talking about and the excretion levels that you see and the body's ability to heal is what those studies show me. You know, they show me that it's worth the effort to pull the plastics, to take your own stainless steel coffee cup, you know, coffee cup to the coffee store that you get your coffee in and don't let them put them in the cardboard cups with the plastic on the inside. Yes. I think a lot of people don't realize like hot things in plastic, heating in plastic, plastic water bottles, just pick one thing, right? I mean, for me personally, Chris, my husband would always bring home this plastic pH water bottle that he loved from Whole Foods. And one day I was just like, this is a non-negotiable for me. You need to start buying Mountain Valley if you cannot remember to bring your own stainless steel water bottle with you.
Yeah.
And I got him a big 40-ounce Yeti and I got glass water bottles delivered to our house for my Christmas present. Cause I was like, I can't do plastic with my kids, especially with my kids. I can't do it with my family. If we want to have multiple children, like this, I need to buck up and do this because we see that in studies. We just see like the body's ability to get rid of these things and to heal and how impactful they can be. And that pool example was so visual. It's exactly what it is.
Well, here's another visual. And I just came across this data recently, but over 75% of the plastic, okay, like just let this sink in for a second. Over 75% of the plastic that has ever been produced on this planet is not being used. So we're using less than 25% probably. I think the statistic was even higher. I'll have to go back and check. But we're using a fraction of the plastic that was ever produced. The rest of it all ends up in landfills. And so for me, our health and our planetary health, especially when we're talking about the next generations, like what do we want to leave for them? I've had the same Life Factory glass water bottle since 2005. Same one. I have dropped that thing in parking lots. I have put hot water, cold water. Yeah. So I want to, you know, think about how are we connecting our own health to the planet's health? I wanted to add to Kelly, because we talked about food and I talked a lot about the excesses. And before I talked about those two questions, what are we getting too much of and what are we getting too little of? And I just want to swing back to food, if you don't mind.
Love that.
Sleep, obviously, we're getting too little of. We're getting too much stress, too little R&R, too little self-care, too little recreation. But when it comes to food, we know that, we think about the Centers for Disease Control. Now we all think about the pandemic, but they do a lot of other things. And one thing that they do is every couple of years, they do something called the NHANES study. And it's looking at data from all around the country on food, you know, lifestyle, all kinds of things. And one of the things they found in the more recent NHANES study is that in every single state in the United States, on average, Americans are getting only 16% of the daily needed amount of fruit and 14% of the daily needed amount of vegetables. And that daily needed amount is based on the lowest possible FDA standard.
Yeah.
Not even based on optimal. So we're probably getting 5 or 10% of optimal. Just to give you an example, our paleo ancestors, and this is not a plug for the paleo diet, which I actually don't give plugs for, but our paleo ancestors got about 100 grams of fiber every day just from foraged food. Our the American Cancer Society and the American College of Gastroenterologists say that we need about 30 grams of fiber every day just to prevent colon cancer. And the average American is getting 15 grams of fiber a day. It's shocking. So just when you look at what we're getting undernourished on, fiber, fruits and vegetables, we know that most women go into pregnancy not just having low levels, but actually insufficient levels of about 12 different nutrients. So we're really undernourished. And, you know, that has to do with having the nutrients we need to build the building blocks to actually make our hormones, the nutrients we need to make the neurotransmitters that make our moods healthy, but also detoxification. So our body's ability to take these environmental chemicals that we're getting exposed to and our own hormonal breakdown products is a nutrient-dependent process, meaning that all that detoxification requires things like calcium, magnesium, sulfur compounds from our vegetables, the compounds that make our fruits blue, black, purple, orange, red, and yellow. And so we're not getting those. And so a lot of my work is just around reminding us to nourish ourselves optimally. But there are specific ways to do it that also help you have hormone health and also help you prevent or reverse a lot of these conditions that we've been talking about, like period pain, PMS, PCOS, fertility challenges, endometriosis, etc.
I love it. I mean, you're obviously preaching to the choir.
Of course.
But when I just look at what you said, when you're eating whole foods and you're including plant-based foods, fruits and vegetables that provide those phytochemicals, that provide that fiber, you're feeding that microbiome, you're increasing the amount of stool and actual bowel movements that remove excess estrogens, that remove the toxins, that feed the microbiome, that create that healthy layer of bacteria. I mean, it is this whole holistic approach of one bite at a time, one meal at a time, making the choice,
yes,
making the choice to level up your nutrition, increase your nutrient density, and see that multiply and fan out throughout all of the health that you can experience in your body is so, so powerful. And I think we can feel overwhelmed when we think about what we might be getting too much of. But I love that you your questions, what am I getting too much of and what am I getting too little of, are so simple yet so profound for people, because they can just take a minute and say, yeah, maybe there's too much plastic in my life or processed foods, but how can I, instead of focusing on making those more automatic and just not buying them, just buying the glass or the stainless steel water bottle, but then really leaning into what am I getting too little of? Because we can't be just hitting these minimums. That 30 gram of protein or fiber that you mentioned to prevent colon cancer and what our ancestors used to have the abundance of, we need to be proactive with our fruits and veggies. We need to be proactive with fiber, and we need to do it with starting with our kids.
Yeah, totally. You know, it's so funny because people say, oh my gosh, when I say get, 8 to 10 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, and I can see the person be like, that's so much. But if you think about it, if you like green drinks and you have a green drink in the morning, even if you have it with a breakfast of eggs and whatever you like, if you have a green drink, you're getting 2 servings of greens, maybe a couple of carrots and an apple. So right there, you've gotten 4 or 5 servings of fruits and vegetables. Then if you have a big salad at lunch and then maybe a portion of broccoli, that steamed or some steamed kale and a sweet potato at dinner, boom, you're done. And for me, I find sometimes, and I garden, I have a massive garden, but even still, I find it's like an extra step to wash all those veggies, And so do it twice a week. Make a big salad. Don't dress it. If you dress it, then you have to eat it. But if you don't dress it, a good salad will last in the fridge for 3 days. You eat off of that. You add your salmon to it one day. You add some hummus to it another day. It just becomes much more second nature. I don't have to think about it anymore. You're probably the same way.
Well, it's exactly, I call it meal prep light. I think people have this idea that they need to spend 8 hours in their kitchen on Sunday. And I am just a proponent of how can you prepare your veggies. If you know you're going to roast your cauliflower and you have a big head of cauliflower, you know you're going to make a salad. How can you rinse that romaine and wrap it in a kitchen towel and your fridge so it stays crisp? How can you, rinse and chop some crudité veggies and chop up the veggies you're going to roast and do that twice a week so that when you go to make dinner fresh or lunch fresh for your family, it isn't taking you so long, because that is such a barrier to entry for so many of my clients. They're stuck in Zoom calls or they're at the office and they have their kids and they're like, Kelly, this, can I just do meal delivery? Can I just, and those can be, bridges to get through tough times, but I'm like, we can, it doesn't need to be, you don't need to be Martha Stewart. It is just about simply prepared foods and doing what you're saying, which is getting as many fruits and veggies in as you can. One thing that we started doing with Sebastian, and I learned this from a few functional pediatricians, is plant points. Is just, hey, bud, look at all the colors, look at all the plants on your plate. Can you count your plant points for me? Which things are plants? Which things are giving you fiber and greens or colors? And he's so excited about it because Chris gets excited about it. I get excited about it. And that just takes sort of that balance on the plate to the next level. But it really drives it home when you're talking about 30 grams of protein being, or I see saying protein,
fiber,
30 grams of fiber being what prevents colon cancer. We're not just here to prevent things. We're here to feel vibrant and balanced.
Exactly. Yes. And it's so important with the kids. We raised our kids eating a whole foods diet and they're my kids are now 27 to 36 and they still eat that way. And it's so fun. Now I go to their house, or their apartment, they're making something for me. And it's really, really fun. And it's also about taste buds. And so, I had a really interesting experience. I ate a whole foods diet since I was 15 years old. And then when I was in residency, you know, you're up overnight, you're on these overnight shifts, you like end up eating the M&Ms or something like that. And then I went away to Haiti for a month. And the food was so simple. I mean, we had like the bare minimum of vegetables, the bare minimum of meat. And I came back and I'd been gone for a month and I came back and someone had gotten me a muffin and I hadn't had anything like that. Like it wasn't a usual part of my diet and I hadn't had even a taste of anything like that in a month. And I was really, it just like flown in and I took one bite of it and I was like, I'm sorry. I don't mean to be rude. I actually had to spit it out. The amount of sugar when your like palate is completely, because I didn't have access to honey, maple syrup, I mean, nothing. Yeah. And it was really interesting to come back and have just such a stark example of how programmed our taste buds are. And with our kids, if we don't program their taste buds to sugar and fast food when they're young, they actually don't develop a taste for it and they will develop a taste for the fruits and vegetables. Once they have, you know, if you raise kids on other stuff, you kind of have to break them of the habit and the same as adults. But once you break the habit and you get your taste buds loving greens and loving healthy food, that other stuff doesn't taste good. It's so, do you find that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because I also tell my clients when we're talking about like building these, because what we're ultimately doing is this balance that you create in your life, whether it's with food, sleep, or lifestyle. When you start your kids a certain way, like what you're saying, it's so much easier than having to break habits. And but one thing I always bring up to my clients is how, if you put yourself in your child's body and think about what you fed them for the day, whether that's like a blueberry muffin, a kid's meal of chicken and French fries, chicken fingers and French fries, a piece of pizza, if you ate that way for a week, how would you feel? Because we don't take ownership. It's amazing. Like we want to eat healthy ourselves, but then it's quick and fast and easy for our kids. And it's literally that question that can change it for everyone, yeah. Which is, it's
and a lot of moms. I think a lot of moms too end up eating what I call the toddler diet. So the mom is ending up eating the chicken nuggets and the little bit of this. So you're kind of grazing on the kid food all day instead of actually stopping and having a healthy meal. And for me, this is just about nourishment. You know, there is so much overload. And back to that question of like, where am I overloaded and where am I undernourished? I mean, to me, that's a question to ask ourselves every single day when we're feeling a little stressed. Like, okay, what am I taking on too much of right now? What is there too much of that is making me feel taxed and burdened? And what is there too little of that I need for nourishment? And it may be as simple as like, I need to get off of social media and take 15 minutes to just do some deep breathing, or I need to unschedule something and go out for a walk. Sometimes we just need quiet, or we just need a minute to ourselves. And sometimes we're like, ah, I haven't eaten all day. That's why I'm having this headache. I don't need the coffee and the sugar and the ibuprofen. I just actually need to eat a salad and throw a piece of salmon in it. Yeah.
Real food.
Exactly.
I love it. Well, let's head back into hormones for the last few minutes of the show. Mm-hmm. I'd love to know your thoughts on some of the myths that you see out there when it comes to hormones and some of the things that you wish women knew.
So I would say the first myth is that it's our fault or there's something wrong with us. Going back to what we said earlier, that's not true. Another really important myth is that there's a perfect menstrual cycle. And I think that, you know, as period health has become more of a conversation in the wellness space, it's also become a brand that people have. And sometimes we can start to be told that our period has to be a certain color. It has to show up at a certain interval. It has, you know, be a certain way, but periods have way more variation than that. I would say another myth is that, if you don't get pregnant within 6 to 12 months, you have to go down the road of fertility treatment. On average, people who try for 2 years, 90% of people will get pregnant completely naturally. Now, I understand that that may sound like a really long time. And if you don't feel like you have that window, I mean, my book is equally supportive of things that you could do to enhance fertility, support yourself if you're using the pill, all these things. So it's not an all or nothing book. But I think that people get pushed down a very medication heavy, very cost heavy and time intensive fertility road way too prematurely. And I would say another myth, and this is really a medical myth, is that the pill is no big deal. I'm not against women using the pill, but it is actually a big deal. It depletes our nutrients. It absolutely is a high risk factor for increasing depression. And there are some more significant risks that it can cause, like clots. And so if you are taking the pill, it's super important to bump up your nutrients with a multivitamin and vitamin D. It's important to make sure that the root cause that you're put on the pill for is addressed, because 60% of people are on the pill not for contraception, but for some hormone imbalance, and to know the risks, just to be really aware. I would say those are some big ones. I would tag on the same thing with hormone replacement therapy for women in menopause. It's not no big deal. Hormone replacement therapy is the equivalent of the pill for women going through menopause in the way that it's doled out. So I would say those are some of the big ones.
I love it. Is there anything we should know that you would want everyone to know about balancing their hormones? What would be like the two biggest recommendations you'd make to clients or patients if they just came into your office and they were feeling very overwhelmed?
Yeah. So the first thing is just start paying attention to your cycle. You can either use a physical cycle tracker, you know, where pen and paper, or you can get a cycle tracker just to start to pay attention to when things are happening, because you want to collect data. It's usually not just random. It's usually like, okay, I'm getting this headache or this breakout at the same time every month. Because once you have that data, you can use a book like mine. You can bring that data to a naturopath, nurse practitioner, midwife, doctor, and they can say, oh, that's usually when progesterone is doing this or estrogen is doing that. So just learning your body is so important. And then I think the second thing would be, I would lean into food. You know, if there are changes that are hard to make, you work a night shift, you have kids and they're waking you up at night, you know, maybe sleep is harder to come by. Work on your food, because it is so, the nutrition part of it is so important. Not restriction, but really deeply nourishing what your body needs for hormone health.
I love it. We have to end there, because that just rings all the bells, all my bells of happiness
you,
over here.
Right.
I'm like banging the drum.
Sense.
I'm banging the drum. Oh, Aviva,
that was my entry into all of it, was food politics and how food affects our health. So
I love it. Well, we're going to end with one question, and that is, what does body love mean to you?
Oh, wow. Honestly, I think it just means listening to my body, dropping in and listening to my body and just being grateful. So easy to judge our bodies, hate on our bodies, criticize our bodies. So just that dropping in and having appreciation for, like, okay, you do all this for me every day. You've gotten me here. Just taking that time to say thank you.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. I'm so excited to get this episode out to my audience and share all the amazing hormone intelligence that you're sharing with your community, with mine. So thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you, Kelly.
Thank you for listening to Be Well by Kelly. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at bewellbykelly.com and follow me on Instagram at bewellbykelly. I would love if you picked up my books, Body Love and Body Love Every Day. They're sold on Amazon and at all major booksellers.